you're going to speak about curvature.
Hey, bueno? Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, okay. Thanks. I'm sorry for the difficulties. I don't know what happened with the Skype connection. Right now I'm in a different computer, so I just have to have my talk here. Hello, everyone. The subject of my talk is curvature. And first, I like to start with some motivation, just because most of the talk is going to be about really the definition of the curvature function. And now we are in, apart from the, before everything, I'm sorry for the disorganization, the work is in collaboration with Homero Diaz-Marin, and my PhD student that is about to graduate. Okay, so the first motivation and definition, we are in the slide now that has applications to effective theories of connections. Okay, and there, what we are going to be able to do after we define the curvature function is to have a reconstruction of the bundle from a discrete set of data. So if we know the connection only through some discrete set of data related to it, we are going to be able to reconstruct the connection that the bundle that has it can have this connection. And later we are going to give some, from that discrete set of data, some approximate localization result that says that the connection is constrained to be near something, and I'm going to be more precise about this when I arrive to that. Later we are going to describe how to do coarse graining, starting using these observables or functions, and we are going to talk also a little bit about regularization. So the next slide, now application to geometry and topology of fiber bundles. First, again, the reconstruction result. And later, more on the geometric side, we have a non-Abelian Stokes formula that comes with this connection, with this definition of curvature. And we are going to talk also a little bit, very briefly, about invariants of principal fiber bundles. Now it comes the definition of curvature. So we are in a slide now that has a heading called notation, and it's just a necessary notation to be able to define everything that I'm going to define. And so M means a smooth manifold. Pi is a smooth principal fiber bundle with the structure group G, and by calligraphic A pi is the space of connections, smooth connections on that bundle. And the A mod G with the star means modulo gauge transformations that are the identity on the fiber. And okay, later, the other thing I'm going to need very strongly is L, that is the space of loops that are based on the base point, and then modulo reparametrization and retracing, so that is a group. And it has a subgroup of the loops that are contractible. Okay, we continue the next slide about notation. Given one such loop or class of loops and one connection modulo gauge, I can define the holonomy that is an application, a map that goes from the fiber on top of star to itself, and after we identify the fiber with the group, then we have an action of the group in itself, and so to the holonomy we assign a group element. Okay, now the preliminaries of the function that is called curvature. For that we are going to need a surface that is with boundary, and the boundary has to be piecewise smooth so that we can calculate the holonomy we are going to need, and the surface has to be contractible. Then we need an auxiliary path, gamma, that is piecewise smooth and starts at start and finishes at some point in the boundary of S, then given that a pair of S and gamma, then we can define a loop that is prescribed by the boundary of the surface S. Okay? These are the main ingredients. Now, to be able to define the curvature function, I need to like inflate that surface. What I have is a one-parameter family of surfaces, ST, such that the three conditions that are down there are satisfied. First, that it is a subset of S, and then that the loops generated by the boundary of ST can be made loops. So the boundary of ST has to include that point X where the auxiliary curve gamma finishes. Okay, and then we have the condition number 3 that says that for t equal to 0, then we have something that is equivalent to the star. So it's just a retracing of the path gamma. And for t equal to 1, we recover the surface S. And the boundary is just the boundary of the surface S. So we go to the next slide, and we consider a connection modulo gauge. And with it, and the construction before, we can define a curve inside the group G. And for every T from 0 to 1, we assign to it the holonomy of that curve, okay, of that loop. It's important to see that C of 0 is equal to the identity, and C of 1 is equal to the holonomy of the boundary of S. Okay. With it, now we are going to define another curve that is inside the Lie group G, the Lie algebra of the group G. And what we do is that since Lie G covers G, then we ask that the new curve is such that the exponential that is the covering map, the exponential goes down to the original curve C of T, and that the beginning point of this new curve C tilde is the origin. With this, we define a unique lifting curve, and then the next slide that says definition of curvature says that the end of that curve is equal to the curvature function. So we have a function now, f of s, that takes a connection and computes its curvature with the aid of a path gamma. Okay, this is a Lie algebra valued function given a connection and a surface with boundary and this auxiliary path. Okay, one can say that this was a very convoluted construction, but it is independent of the choice of this way of inflating the boundary, and that is because we ask the surface S to be contractible. If it were not, we would not have such a uniqueness thing. It would depend on the way you inflated it, in the way you go to the boundary. You have to trust me, but the main argument is that if you have two such choices, S of T and S prime of T, then we will generate two curves, C and C prime, and the new curve C prime in the Lie group G will be homotopic to the original. Okay? And then when we lift it to the Lie algebra, we will have the same endpoint. Not the same curve, but the same beginning and endpoint, because they have to be homotopic, and that's the only way for it to happen. Okay? An important reminder is that the exponential of this function fs recovers the holonomy on the boundary. Here I like to stop for a second because I like to know if there are any questions about this definition. The rest is going to be examples and applications. Do you want to ask anything now or prefer after the one example?
I have a question about your lifting of the curve in the Lie algebra. Why is that unique? I mean, it's not true that if I get a element of the group, there's a unique element of the Lie algebra that will exponentiate it to, right?
So if I just have a point in the group, there are many points in the Lie algebra whose exponential is that point. Now what we have is not a point, but we have a curve. And the curve in G is a curve that starts in the identity and is a continuous path. So what we can do is list it in a unique way once we specify the initial condition in the Lie algebra. So we say that the initial condition in the group is the identity because it is by construction, and in the Lie algebra we have to give it as an input. And we say that it starts in the origin. Once we do that, we just list it by continuity, and there is a unique lift of that curve once the initial point is fixed. And then the definition of the function is the endpoint of that unique curve. Is it clear, or should I go through some more detail?
Just go ahead. Thank you.
Okay, and maybe someone else has a question? No? If not, let's see the example first. Okay, so an example. And this example is quite geometric, let's see. So the base manifold we take as the sphere, and the group is O2, that is homeomorphic to S1, to the circle, and for pi that we need to be a principal bundle, we take the associated bundle to the frame bundle, and the connection that we want to use is induced by the Levi-Civita connection in the round unit sphere. So we have the geometric setting there, then parallel transport on curves in these group elements of SO2 that mean how much a vector will rotate in the frame bundle, but we have it expressed in this principal bundle associated to it. So before doing any application of the main definition, I will tell you what is the result, because the main definition was constructed so that what happens is that the curvature on a surface S, that is a subset of the sphere, that we imagine it to be quite big, covering almost all the sphere except for a little bit, then the curvature is the area, and it's a real number. Four pi will be the maximum, the curvature of the whole sphere. And the holonomy on the boundary is an angle associated to that surface. Okay, and it's an element of SO2. Now, if we calculate it according to the general definition, let's see what happens. We construct a curve CT that gives us an angle of a surface ST. So now imagine how is that this surface ST is. We have a fixed point, say, in the boundary of S, and ST for t equal to 0 is just that point and gets inflated up to it covers almost the whole S, the whole surface S, and until it finishes. So it gets inflated from a point up to it covers almost the whole sphere, because we imagine the surface S to be very big, and it stops at the boundary of that surface. So when we calculate the curve CT, we get an angle that winds in SO2, that is the circle, more than once. It passes through 2 pi, so it goes around the circle and continues. Then the lift CT there of T, now we imagine it in the real line, that is an unrolling of the curve that I just described. It starts at 0 in the reals and finishes at FS, that is equal to the area of the surface. Here the example finishes. Do you have any questions now?
Hello?
Hello?
So what's confusing is this is an abelian example, and the exponentiation is unique, but in a generic non-abelian Lie algebra, the exponentiation of the algebra element to a group is to a group element is not unique. There are ordering issues, and that, I guess.
The exponential is the differential geometric exponential. So the once you have a Lie group, you define the Lie algebra as the tangent to the identity, and there you have vectors, and these vectors define geodesics, and you follow them, and so the exponential map from a Lie algebra to the Lie group is a completely well-defined object in non-abelian cases too. Here I just gave this example of the abelian case because it was easier to imagine. But for example, the exponential map also exists in the sphere in S2 if you want. It is not a group associated to it, but you have a sphere on top of the table, and then the table is the tangent plane to some point, and you can do this exponential of two vectors, just and geodesics, and you follow them for a finite time t, and that defines an exponential map. Another question?
Maybe it'll become clear that you're going to talk about the non-abelian Stokes theorem, and maybe that'll become clear.
Yeah, but everything depends on the exponential map. That is a map from the Lie algebra to G, and it is well defined for any Lie group G. It covers only the connected component to the identity, but that's a well defined map. Okay, so we continue with something that is going to use the same the same machinery. So if someone else has another question about the exponential map, probably we should take it again. Is there another question about that? Okay, we continue. So now, just this is going to be faster than the other thing because it follows the same ideas. I mean the Dirichlet-Lifted parallel transport. So here I'm going to do it inside a local trivialization. And so I have this function t tilde gamma of a, so that it is supposed to lift the parallel transport from a curve that was in the Lie group to something that is now in the Lie algebra. And so the function t tilde is Lie algebra valued again, and it is the endpoint of the lift of a curve as the other one. So what I do is that I have a gamma path inside the neighborhood U alpha that has to be such that I can compute the parallel transport, and I consider subpaths of gamma that start at the beginning point and then get longer up to the end point. Okay, and for each of these paths, I then have a group element because the local trivialization allows me to have a group element. And then what we get is, again, a curve in G, and I lift it starting from 0 in the Lie algebra, and that defines a Lie algebra valued function for each path in gamma. I just have a remark that I could substitute ingredients in this recipe, and instead of a local trivialization, I could have an auxiliary connection A0, and I would be able to do the same because I could define a curve using that one, a curve in the Lie group, and I will lift it again. Okay, so now it comes the reminder of the Stokes formula for calculus of manifolds. So I'm in this slide called Stokes formula, and I'm not going to follow the most frequent presentation, but the one that is in Arnold's classical mechanics book. And what he does is that he has a definition of the Stokes theorem and makes it a definition. Okay, so it has this relation about between the integral of the form d omega in S and the integral in the boundary of omega. Okay, and the formula defines the concept of the differential, exterior differential of a curve. the formula defines it. And then there is a theorem, I mean, something gets to be changed by definition and theorem are interchanged, but now what you don't know is what's the local expression of d omega, and the theorem says that if the expression for omega is omega I dxi, then the local expression of d omega of the differential is right there, okay? Now, in the same spirit, we go to the next slide, the non-abelian Stokes formula, and this is in collaboration with another student, Alejandro Soto, and here we have a definition, okay, and the definition is with respect to a local trivialization again, and this is the one that you see in your screen, okay? And it is very much in the spirit of the Stokes formula before. I don't perform an integral in two dimensions, but I change it for an integral in one dimension in the boundary. Here, the integral is the path order exponential, as we know, of A, but lifted now to the D algebra. Okay? And so I have another definition for the same object, and here I don't have time, but it can be proven to be the same as the previous definition, and that happens only when the local trivialization is contractible. Before I needed the surface to be contractible, and I really need the surface, the whole surface to be inside the local trivialization, and that would be enough. Okay? Yeah, that's what I need. The surface S to be completely contained in the local trivialization, not only the boundary, but the whole surface. Okay? So we come to the next slide. The next slide is about...
But Jose Antonio, yeah. I mean, the key point is...
Okay.
Maybe that's what you're going to do. But with the Arnold's definition, you know, which is turning the differential definition into an integral definition and then proving the differential formula.
Yeah.
So what is the differential formula for integral of... I mean, you're just defining this, right? That.
Yeah, that's what's coming.
Oh, that's correct. Okay.
Yeah, so it comes the next thing that I in the slide called structural equation, okay, and it says the form. It is about the local form of f. If I have defined only f as a function on surfaces, what does it have to do with the curvature that I knew that was a thing that you evaluated on points and you got a two form that was the algebra value. Okay, what you have to do is you have to define a limit very much in the spirit of how the local formula for the d omega is obtained in the case of calculus of manifolds. What you need to do is to shrink the surface to a point in a way that is dictated by two vectors that gives you the two form. So here you do the same. You have a family of surfaces, S, that are dictated by two vectors and a base point. So you have a point in the manifold, X, and two vectors on it in the tangent space. And then using the local, the chart, then you define some curved parallelogram that is just the image of a real parallelogram in the tangent space or in the chart, and then you put it in the manifold. So it comes as a curved parallelogram, and it depends on two vectors. Now, when you make the vectors small, it comes to a point, and the formula is exactly like you have it in the screen. The two vectors, you multiply them by epsilon, and then you take that epsilon to zero, and then you get some surface that is smaller and smaller, and then the curvature function, that is the algebra value, gets to be smaller and smaller, but the way in which it goes to zero, divided by epsilon squared, gives you something. That thing, you can show that it has, like Arnold calls it, a principal linear part, and that one can be written in terms of coordinates, or in terms of the local expression of the connection, and that's the formula that is down there.
No, this is not what I meant. I mean, okay, this we all knew, right?
This isn't technical. Yes, yes.
Okay. So, if you just give me the definition of holonomy, and if I just shrink this curve, then if I started out by definition of the field strength, which is at the bottom of your transparency, I recover that. It's something that we know from books and everywhere and everywhere, and we use it all the time.
Yeah. I'm not claiming that I proved this from the beginning.
This
proof is contained in the, if you read the proof of the Ambrose-Singer theorem, the first three lines cover this thing, but it's phrased in terms of holonomies. But the same, exactly the same lines go through, and then you prove what I have here. It's not a new result. In the sense, the novelty comes from the function that I defined originally, the f of s. So that thing that is a Lie algebra value function from surfaces is an object that usually is not presented, but it exists here, and it has this property. Any more questions?
No, I don't know. That's the key point. That is the key point that you're making, and I don't understand that key point. Okay, so in the abelian case, okay, at the end of the day, I do obtain a two form.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there is an integration theory of integrals of two form. And I can now verify that if I did integrate that two form or the manifold, I recover the integral of the one form around its boundary.
Yeah.
Now here, at the end of the day, you are giving us two forms. What is the relation between the integral of these two forms and the holonomy? You haven't told us that. So that is a non-trivial part. I think that is what perhaps Lie was referring to.
In the just after the definition of the curvature function, I said go back to the page for definition of curvature function. And it defines f of a is the end point of a curve. Okay, it looks very abstract, and then I say just in the bottom of that page that by construction the exponential of that function is equal to the holonomy of the boundary.
Yeah, but it's not a definition. I mean, it's nothing like construction in the thing. There's nothing. I mean, let me just start again. I mean, one last time. Okay. In the abelian case, one could have done exactly what you're saying. Namely, one could have said that I define the integral of curvature to be the holonomy.
Yeah.
And then I can go on from there.
The integral of curvature to be the logarithm of the holonomy.
Right. So I could have. So that's a definition, okay? Then there is the converse theorem, namely that, in fact, locally, this curvature, so defined, is given by a differential formula. But
there's a
third line, which you did not say, and that's the important one, namely, now I know what I mean by integral of two forms. And when I do perform the integral of these two forms, I started out with. And this curve is missing in the non-abelian case that you're told us so far.
I disagree completely because in the abelian case, that's just direct, as you said, and that is because of some sort of a linearity. Here, the integral of a two-form, I did define a Lie algebra value two-form, but it's one thing that I cannot just integrate because we know that what carries the geometrical information is that behavior of the holonomy of the parallel transport on the boundary that has to be composed and is not really an integral. It's a fast order exponential, if you want to call it like that. So the definition of the curvature function, it says how to do it. It says that what you have to do is follow the information that you have in the curve in the group and lift it to the Lie algebra, and that is saying, in fact, I'm calculating originally the curvature as inflating a surface. Okay, then that is very much the idea of integration in two dimensions, but to have a correct formula, it has to follow the knowledge of the parallel transport.
Okay, can I, Jose Antonio, I think we're confused by the same thing. And if you're on the slide that says non-abelian Stokes theorem, so there is a non-abelian Stokes theorem, which is presumably what you mean by the previous definition, and that requires giving a rather complicated definition in terms of a limit of subdividing the surface. And
that's why I'm changing the spirit. You see, there are two ways of presenting the result of relating integrals in the bulk and the boundary. And I'm following the presentation of Arnold, that is, I make that integral definition and then I go to the local part.
Right.
I change the order in that. And why did I do it? To avoid that other thing. Then I still need to do some work, and the work is to provide the local formula for the curvature as a differential two-form valued in the Lie algebra. And that's what I do in the structural equation.
So let me just ask a question. In the standard definition of the non-abelian Stokes theorem, there's a dependence on the detailed construction of how you subdivide the surface, and if I remember right, the expression depends on that. For a flat connection, of course, it doesn't, or a flat function, it doesn't, but generically it does. If you filled in the details when you say that your definition agrees with the previous definition, is then your definition can be seen as giving a prescription for adding up all the little Lie algebra value two forms over the two surfaces?
And that's a good question. Like the other one too. When I said in the Stokes formula, see the slide, non-abelian Stokes formula definition, non-abelian Stokes formula, that one is a definition about that is, if you read it, it's again a lift, but a lift of a curve in the group that I built only by going around the boundary, okay? And before I had given a definition about lifting another curve that had to do with inflating a surface from a point up to the complete surface stopped by the boundary of the surface. Okay?
Right.
Can I say that it can be proven to agree with the previous definition? The proof of this thing is about what are the types of curves that I can get. First, I also have to tell you that it's independent of the way in which I construct an auxiliary curve in the Lie group G. And since I ask that the curve S is contractible, then there is a theorem, if you want, or a lemma, that says that all these different ways of going from a part that is equivalent to the starting point and one that covers the whole boundary, they are all curves in the Lie group that are homotopic. And that happens only because I ask the surface S to be contractible. Okay, when I and that's probably the key of all this, first that the definitions are independent of my choices, and then also that the previous definition, the related blowing up to inflating a surface, and this one that is going around the boundary, they are both aspects of the same, they are both justified by the same lemma that says that these curves are all homotopic. And this happens only because I ask the surface S to be contractible. And for example, it would be illuminating if you go to the example of the sphere. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have a drawing, but if you imagine the sphere and a path in it that is very close to the North Pole, for example, then the holonomy would be very close to the identity, and there are two surfaces that bound that path, one that is a little cask near the pole, and the other one that is the whole Earth below it in the southern hemisphere, and they have very different curvatures. Okay, so I have to say how is that I'm going to inflate what surface I'm going to use. I have to give that information. I'm not giving a prescription to give a Lie algebra value function that is related to a curve. I'm giving it as I need to a surface, and that's because I need to say how is that I inflate that curve. Sorry, I don't know if I made any clarification. Any more questions?
Just tell us which slide you're getting back to.
Okay. Let's say if you all went through this structural equation and I agree with the fact that it's not a result that is difficult to prove, it's just contained in books. Okay. Usually books don't have this function S of the pair of vectors, but they do have the pair of vectors giving a loop, okay? And then you do it through the holonomy, and that is related to the Ambrose Singer theorem. And then I go to the next slide, because we change subject if things, or let's change the subject, and then if you have questions on what follows, we can go back. Okay, so now is the applications. Okay, and I come here to effective theories of connections. And let me put that setting, and then you can complete, and we can go back, because what I care more about is this definition of the curvature function. So, okay, so we are in the effective theories of connection, and here the preliminaries are that if I had a smooth manifold, now I give to it a triangulation that is going to let me define a discrete set of data, and what I have there is a subgroup of the group of loops based on the star, okay, and these are the ones that fit in a lattice, okay, and also I have an array of surfaces that are given by the plaquettes of the triangulations, the two-dimensional symphysis, okay, and
I have a question about, I don't know your notation, but what is L and LD, delta, 1, LD, delta?
Oh, okay. L is a one-dimensional lattice embedded in M. And so if I have a triangulation, I imagine it as some Euclidean triangulation that is called the geometric realization, given a homomorphism from that to M. And then LD, delta, is a polycentric subdivision of that triangulation. So for every triangle, every simplex in the triangulation, I have to subdivide it to make it finer. Probably today I cannot give more details given the time constraints. But then I keep the one skeleton of that. So I have a triangulation and I keep only the links and the vertices. Okay? And then in the second notational thing that has a superscript 2 means that I have the synthesis of dimension 2. Okay? And this phi of this SD delta sub 2, so super 2, means that I have these curved triangles in the manifold M. So I mean manifold M can be of any dimension, but it has some little triangles that are curved because they are the image of real Euclidean triangles. Okay, and then I will use these real surfaces, triangles, to evaluate the curvature and generate from that this discrete set of data. Okay, so I'm in the next slide that says that now given a connection modulo gauge, I consider these families of evaluation of the functions that there are in your screen. So for every little triangle of the triangulation, two-dimensional object with boundary, then I evaluate the function f on the smooth connection A. Okay? And then what I get is set of Lie algebra elements, okay, I consider all of them, that all the ones that are independent. For example, in two dimensions, I will consider all of them. If there are some kind of Bianchi identities in dimensions three or higher, then I don't consider them all. Okay? And the notion of independence is rather subtle. That's why we have two definitions, one with a check and one without a check. And the one with a check means that I'm ignoring for the moment the knowledge of the bundle structure pi. Okay, I'm just getting this thing as Lie algebra valued functions on surfaces that satisfy something for every connection independently of whether it comes from the bundle pi or bundle pi prime with the same base space and structure group. Then in the second line I have this same objects but without the check accent, and there I do have do consider things as independent only according to whether they are independent or not as functions of the connection in the space of connections with over pi, of the bundle pi. Okay? And this is the data for effective theories of connections when I don't have a non-contractible loop. So for the moment, I restrict to the manifold being a sphere of dimension d, so I don't have to deal with non-contractible loops. And then I have a slide called characterization theorem, and there it says that among the principal fiber bundles with the same base space and same structure group, the bundle pi is characterized by that discrete set of data. In the sense that I could have another connection in a possibly different bundle, but if it shares that data, then the two bundles need to be equivalent in the sense that there is a bundle map from one to the other one that is the identity, anyway, from a bundle equivalence map. Okay, so this is the characterization theorem. I'm not going to prove it. There is an illustration of it in two dimensions in two slides. I may skip it because of the time. But did you understand the statement? This statement is analogous to a statement in the continuum that holonomies characterize the bundle. But here in the discrete, if I have a discrete set of holonomies, they do not characterize the bundle. There are infinitely many bundles in some cases with the same data. In some other cases, there is only one. There is also a broader theorem that is the approximate localization theorem that says that if I have two connections modulo gauge that share.
Jose, I'm confused by your last statement because your last statement is just the contrary of what's written on your slide. So, you say that the. Okay, so can you clarify? And you say that it's enough to have the discrete data to characterize the bundle, and you say.
I'm saying that if I have data that are holonomies, then they are not enough to characterize the bundle. If I have data that are not holonomies but curvatures, then I do have enough data to characterize the bundle. So the
what do you mean by curvatures? So the log of
this omega, this data, check omega, if you go back to the definition,
you take the log of the holonomy, you're saying.
Kind of the log, yeah, you have to. But the log, you have to imagine it as characterizing the homotopy type of the curve of holonomies. So you don't know the whole holonomy everywhere for every loop, but you have only a discrete set of loops, and there what you have is not the holonomy, but the homotopy type of how it will grow the holonomy from a null loop to the loop you are talking about. And so you are actually the this characterization theorem may help understanding the nature of the curvature function. It has to do with the homotopy type of curves related to the holonomy. Okay, so then any other question about the characterization theorem? Okay. Then comes the approximate localization that says if I have two connections in the same bundle that share the data, then I like to be able to say that they are close to each other, okay, in some sense. And the statement is that I can deform these two connections to the same one that I call A delta. And this deformation obviously loses information because A1 and A2 may differ in many details, but somehow in the coarse sense they are the same, in the coarse sense in the sense of delta. And then I am able to map them to the same connection modulo gauge in some space of connections that allows curvature singularities and that they are flat somewhere. So in a sense I simplify them both the maximum in a local way, and they can both be deformed to the same. So this is the theorem about approximate localization.
Can you tell us in words what this means? I mean, there are many symbols there. So you're saying that two connections are deformations, provided what happens?
Okay, so the first line of the theorem is that I have two connections, A1 and A2, that share the data. Okay? Then, what I want to state here is that both of these connections, I can take them to the connection A sub delta by local deformations. And local deformations means, in fact, that I can have some homeomorphisms that are almost everywhere smooth, but except in some smaller subsets, such that when I iterate them, I kind of push the curvature to some place that has now curvature singularities. So from in the triangulation delta, there is some space that I'm going to use to put curvature singularities. That is a codimension 2 skeleton of some refinement of that triangulation. But so I have some two-dimensional object inside the manifold M, and the manifold M could be four-dimensional, for example. And I have this two-dimensional place where I'm going to hide curvature, and what I do with the connection A1, say that it's smooth everywhere, is I deform it by pushing the curvature away in the direction of this place, and I hide it all there, so it becomes a singular place, so the connection is flat everywhere, except in this place that has some distributional character, okay, like a conical singularity. I make conical singularities with this way. And so if I use this procedure to flatten the connection A1 and flatten the connection A2, they reach to the same connection with conical singularities. That is flat everywhere except for the conical singularities. And so this is the statement of being close to each other, that by local deformation, so these different organisms that I told you, they are not wild, but they are only local in the sense that they preserve each simplex of the triangulation. So and that's what it means here. So they can be locally deformed to the same. Okay, and I understand that it's not very simple to understand so fast. I just want to compare and contrast these two theorems with one by Barrett and stated in a little bit less complete form by Kobayashi, that says that the holonomy is given a smooth manifold, you can characterize the bond, principal bundles over it, only knowing the holonomies, okay? And you could also characterize the connection modulo gauge. Here what I'm doing is breaking the theorem into two, because the boundary structure I can recover completely, the connection I cannot recover exactly, only approximately, by these means of local deformations. And another thing related to that theorem is that the discrete analog of that theorem is stated in terms of an intention to characterize the boundary structure from holonomy functions, it doesn't go through. Okay, you need this more information that is the logarithms, the curvature functions. Okay, I guess I can. Since I, how long do I have, or should I take questions now?
You can go a few minutes more and then questions.
Okay, so better I can go to the slide called coarse graining and do it quite fast. So I'm in the slide called coarse graining, and the issue is there to analyze what if I have this data to define effective theories using first a triangulation delta and a triangulation delta prime that are somehow one a refinement of the other. Am I able to get the coarser data by the knowledge of the finer data? And the answer is yes. I'm not going to go through the details, but the answer is yes. You go to the next slide. It says theorem coarse graining. So it says that the function, curvature function on a simplex legal triangle sigma of the coarse triangulation can be calculated using similar functions on the finer triangulation, where I have something called a composition lifted, and that thing is kind of a deformation of the sum. And what it means is right there in the theorem. So I have to define that object that is a deformation, is like a non-linear addition for the Lie algebra. So this thing happens in the Lie algebra, and it has to codify the composition of holonomies or parallel transports. Okay, so let me just explain that ingredient here, because it's an important one. So the way in which I defined the curvature function was lifting a course that was already in the group and lifted to the Lie algebra. And to do that, I needed an initial point of the course. And I took originally, before right now, I took the origin of the Lie algebra, the zero of that vector space. Now, if I first do the if I take another initial point related to the evaluation of the curvature function in a linear surface, okay, then I can start from it and lift the curve again, and that is the definition. Okay, it's probably clear if you read it from the screen. Okay, then that's the coarse graining prescription. I mean, right now I just have an equality there, and I can prove it. And if I want to use this data for effective theories, a single effective theory is kind of useless. I need to have families of them and be able to coarse grain. And so what I will do, if I have sets of Lie algebra values, a discrete set of Lie algebra elements that correspond to an effective configuration, I want to be able to coarse grain it, and I will use it, that new symbol, circle tilde. Okay, so we go to the next slide to understand this.
Jose Antonio, and you have got a result which says that if I did coarse graining in two steps and arrived at some super coarse grain thing, and you did it in different steps and arrived at the same coarse grain thing,
yeah.
So our compositions in terms of the circle operations are quite different from each other. But you have a result which says that the final result is the same?
Yes. The final result is, it's again this thing about whether there are many curves that leave the same. This again can be seen, this formula of the coarse grain theorem. It says that I needed a curve to be lifted, and what it says is that there are many ways of doing that curve, and they are all the same, and by the same lemma, that they are all homotopic to each other. In a sense, what I'm doing is that I already know that the composition of the holonomies is independent of how I do it, because in a way I for record training I skipped a thing that is probably important here, that is that the gamma that I have here, I have a set of surfaces that are coarse and a set of surfaces that are finer, and each of them to be evaluated as a curvature function, they need some auxiliary curves, path gamma, and they need to be compatible. Okay, if they are compatible, then by some retracing identity, that this thing is the same. This thing is what it behaves as we want. I skip that. The little curves gamma are important to be compatible from the finer ones to the coarse, and they are very natural choices when you have refinement by centric subdivision. And for other cases, I don't know if there are solutions to this stuff, but I mean, in the concrete way I'm doing it, yes, these paths obey this rule, and it has to do with the compatibility of this thing, this little path gamma. Here, after that, you can probably imagine that this coarse grinding thing gets to be much more boring when you are in the abelian case. In a sense, this is much more boring because the compatibility issue that Abai is mentioning is not there. But it's still significant that the curvature encodes better this macroscopic information than holonomies. This is the next slide, about regularization. Why don't we jump to the slide called regularization? And that one says, I'm not going to talk much about regularization, just about one simple case, but I do have material for another talk about regularization. And what it says is that some functions are very naturally regularized to this effective theories that I'm given, and I could propose some effective theories and I could regularize from the continuum to them. And one case is the Euler character. So if I have first example in dimension 2 and the group, an abelian group, then the integral of the curvature in M goes to a sum, and that by construction works quite well. So the new function is again a constant function, and it agrees with the value in the continuum. And then I go to the next one, the next slide that says invariants on principal fiber bundles. And what I'm saying there is that this formula that I gave, in particular, I could give it for non-abelian groups, for example. So if I change and don't say that G is equal to U1, I cannot regularize it to this sum in the linear sense, but I will have to put my symbol of how I call grain curvature functions, and then it will go through. So I can somehow, given triangulation, produce things analogous to the Euler character for non-abelian groups. And in the case, for example, of the sphere, they will be invariant objects in a sense. I need to consider the gauge invariant thing because I have my path gamma that makes everything gauge dependent, but I need to take care of that. Okay, and also talking about higher dimensional manifolds, I could do it if I consider functions associated to surfaces embedded in the manifold. If the surfaces are not small and contractible, but say they are non-contractible surfaces, then the numbers that I will get through evaluation of something similar to my Euler characteristic formula, then they will depend on the homology class of the surface, but they will somehow still import information about the bundle. Okay, I am not going to talk more about that because I don't have time. So why don't I go to the last comments so we can have a more a question session. And so the comments, I mean the slide called comments for quantum field theory. And it says that since I have this formula that I have a function called curvature of S and its exponential is the holonomy, it says that if I ignore the rest of the information that is in F and keep only the holonomy, I'm missing some information, and it's very analogous to working with a compact, with a circle instead of with a line, and so in a very precise sense it's a compactified information. If I have only a discrete set of data and I don't keep the curvatures completely but only their exponential, then I compactify the system in a sense. Not the system, but the information that I have is only partial in exactly that sense. Okay, so what else? Then if I have a theory that is pretending to be an effective theory of a quantum field theory, for example, like in the lattice, and I have a given lattice, then I have a compactified version of the system. Okay? If I have in loop quantization framework the shadow state of living a single graph, then still I have a compactified version of the system. Or if I have a spin form model with a given discretization, I have this compactified thing. And then what I need to study is in some continuum limit, in the case of lattice case theory, if this compactification is significant or not. In the case of the loop quantum gravity and the shadow states, it means that really to know the whole measure or the whole theory, I need to know the shadows on all the other states. And if I keep only one single graph, then talking about holonomies gives me probably accurate information, but partial. Partial in a sense that, and partial in a way that is not very useful. It would be more useful if I knew finer and finer graphs and their shadows on them. Then I could recover somehow. I'm not saying an impossibility statement, but that the interpretation of shadow states, for example, or lattice case theory in a finite lattice, states as effective theories is not simple. It is complicated. Okay, and there are some other models which are more friendly to this effective theory interpretation. That is, for example, Rayleigh calculus in the first order formalism. So when you put a connection as being one of the variables, then it already uses curvatures. The deficit angle there is not an angle between, it's not a group value thing, it's a Lie algebra value thing. There is also the SK model, I guess, has something related to logarithms of group elements, as I saw in an article by Conradi and Friedel. Okay, and there are many more models that I'm probably ignoring here, that's why I put these dots, and I'm sorry for my ignorance of the many models, and I didn't have time to list them all. Thank you for listening. Now I receive questions again.
This is Laurent. I have a question. In fact, it's more than a question. It's about to see whether I really understood what was your...
Wait a minute. Here in Morelia, I don't know if they can listen to your question.
Can you call the speakers Can you
hear
the question? Thank you.
Okay, so you said the question and I repeat it because here I have an audience and they cannot hear. I didn't know that. So what's the question?
So the question is about, well, it's more, I want to see whether I really understood what was the main point of the first part of your talk. So,
okay.
What I understand is that we usually have holonomies, which depends on the curve. And you want to define the log of the holonomy.
But that's just a minute.
So this is that usually we have holonomies in this kind of theory, and that I want to define the logarithm for these holonomies.
Okay, continue.
But that's usually ambiguous.
Yeah, but that's usually ambiguous.
Right?
Yes, it is.
So your main claim is that you're saying that if you choose a surface, then you can make the definition of log of an holonomy unambiguous.
Yes. So I use that surface as the ingredient to define the logarithm. In some previous versions of this, I call it a surface logarithm.
Okay. And then the main claim is that essentially this definition of the log depends only on the homotopy class of the surface.
As we know, if we have
is that correct or not?
No, this means that my logarithm first, it depends only on the surface. My auxiliary definition used a family of surfaces. It does not depend on the auxiliary family, but only on the surface.
Okay, and it doesn't depend on the auxiliary family, only on the surface. Now, if I'm in the abelian case, it would be even stronger than that. It would not even depend on the surface.
No, it does. For example, if you are in the sphere.
Because this is an integer, so it cannot depend continuously on the surface. It depends on the...
It does.
It depends on the homotopy class of the surface.
In the homotopy class,
That's what I mean.
Not the H2, exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't depend on the representative in the homotopy class. It depends only on the homotopy class.
Yeah, it depends on, exactly, that was in the sense of the, when I talk about the invariance, I wanted to say that.
Is that the statement also in the non-abelian case, that it depends only on the homotopy class?
Yes, yes. I also, in that non-abelian case, I'm saying that it depends only on the homotopy class, but before giving this statement, I have to make the function gauge invariant, because if not, it depends, I just have a conjugacy class that depends on my auxiliary path gamma.
Okay, yeah, you mean the gauge, okay, yeah.
The gauge invariant, if I define a gauge invariant function from a surface S, it depends only in homotopy class, and that's what I meant.
Okay, so that's what I'm not sure it was clear for everything.
No, I'm still not clear about this, so let me just
ask. So I think this is, for me this is his main point. It's a very important thing, saying that, okay.
My main point was not only about surfaces.
It's the main point of your first thought, but I'm not sure it was clear to Abai or Lee or everybody. It was not even clear to me, so that's why I'm clarifying it. I just understood it at the end, and I think it's a very important point. So that's why
can you just wait for a second? Because it's not clear to me that the two of you are communicating, so let me just make sure. Okay. So, I think it is true that the final definition of F does not depend on the individual auxiliary structures you have used, but only on their homotopy class.
The auxiliary structures S of T.
Yeah.
Does you mean?
Yeah, S of T, only on them.
Okay, wait a minute. Here they are saying that they think it's true that it doesn't depend on the auxiliary structure S T. And what else?
Okay. But supposing I just give you one surface and define this S Now to construct that F itself, I have to use auxiliary structures, even if I give you a surface. Okay. Mm-hmm. But now I take completely different surface.
Yes.
And it is homotopically related to the first one, but it's a different surface, and there will be again auxiliary structures that I use with respect to that.
Yes. Yes. So
in each construction, the F will not depend on the auxiliary structure.
Yes.
But is it true that if the two surfaces that I'm looking at are homotopically I can continuously deformed into each other, then F does not depend on the individual surfaces either?
Yes, that's true. He's asking if I have two surfaces, S and S prime, which are continuously deformed to, which can be deformed to each other, to define my function F of S and F of S prime, I use different auxiliary structures. Anyway, the functions are well defined. Is it true that the two functions do not depend on the surface, but only on the they are the same for these two surfaces that can be deformed to each other? The answer is yes. First, I do have to go to the gauge invariant functions only, and so for example, your question also applies to how is that I define these things. If I have surfaces that are not for whom this thing is interesting, they have to be each of them not contractible to a point. Okay, I have surface S that has non-trivial homology, and surface S prime also. And then to make my definition, I need to put some marks in the surface, because my definition depends on some auxiliary data, and I'm going to use that data. So if I put marks in the surface, then I can use my formulas, and if these marks are that these are subsets, for example, if I have M subset of S such that it's a thin set, and I have M prime subset of S prime that is a thin set, and they put in the way of deforming one to the other, the marks deform one to the other, then I can prove that the evaluation of the function is the same, because in the process of inflating, everything keeps to be deformable to each other. There are curves that I produce for the function f of s and curves for f of s prime, curves of ways to inflate the surface S and S prime, which produce things that are always the same. And that's because of the deformation thing because...
But now you're saying that you need additional condition. The additional condition is that the mark things are also deformed to each other. But in the beginning, I thought that because on each surface, you have the freedom to do continuous deformation. Therefore, you are always guaranteed that the surfaces will go into each other. So you have to tell us what the assumptions are and what they are not.
Yeah. So when I call things about invariants, I did things very, very fast. And I did it very fast because I needed some extra elements, and I didn't consider I had enough time. But so here, the functions f of s, they are significant first in a local way to make this effective theory. But if I want to use them to construct invariants, I can do them in several ways. For example, one way is to triangulate a surface, and then I define F of S for each triangle, and then I use this coarse-graining function composition tilde, but there the marks or whatever I'm talking about amount to saying some sort of an ordering
in that sense. So let's say, if I have these extra elements that let me extend my definition f of s to functions, to surfaces s that are not contractible, because the original definition was for functions that were contractible. Okay, now if I'm not in that category, I need to say how is that I'm going to inflate the surface S. And for that, I need some sort of prescription that can be given in the sense of a mark or on the surface. I have not checked how much it depends on the mark, on this. I have to make the surface contractible.
Okay, so let's
can I try to, because now I'm confused again.
Yeah.
I think your answer is a bit too long. I think what I understand what Abai wanted to know is exactly the same thing I wanted to know, and I'm a bit confused by your answer. So what I understand from your answer, your initial answer of Abai, is that if I define the log of these things, I have to pick a surface. Now, let me state it another way. What I understand you're saying is that the conjugacy class associated with this log is it depends only on the homotopy class.
Okay, wait a minute.
Is that what you want to say?
No, I think we have to clarify the question. Let me also clarify for the Morelian people what we're talking about. So, if we have a curve in embedded in M, that's the possible border of a surface. Okay? If I have that, then I can define the logarithm of the holonomy of that curve by prescription of the surface. And that definition depends only on the cohomology class of the surface. If I have two surfaces that have the same border and are deformable to each other, then the definition f of s is the same. And I don't need any marks or anything. The other aspect of this stuff is if I don't have a curve in states, if I have I want to evaluate the function f of s of a surface with no boundary. That's the thing that where I was talking about marks and no marks. If I have a surface with boundary, my definition it doesn't need any marks and depends only on the homology class of the surface. Okay? Is it clear?
Yeah, it seems to me that, yeah, I mean, it agrees with what I was saying, but is it clear to...
Yeah, I think it's insufficiently clear. I think we are sort of reaching the point of diminishing returns here because now it's getting more and more involved and detailed. So.
Okay. Any other question?
If no more questions, let's thank Santoni again.
Thank you. Any questions here in Morelia?